Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Abracadabra, Create What You Speak, with Ilan Azulay, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Abracadabra, Create What You Speak. I'm Ilan Azulay. I'm your host, spiritual mentor, sound therapist, and a guide for you who are ready to reclaim your power, your gifts, recognize your gifts that were given to you, to every one of us. And this is really a place where we are bringing resources, bringing people with gifts to encourage each one of us to look inside, because everything is in the inside. And I want to thank you for being here. V'areni mekabel al atzmi et mitzvat aseh shel ve'ahavt le'reacha kamocha. I hereby accept on the due commandment, the utterance of love your neighbor, your friend, in the same way that you express love to yourself. And the focus is on yourself first. So we have to focus first on our own gifts for us. How do we talk to ourselves to bring it forward to the world? Today, it is a wonderful opportunity. I'm so blessed to have here, to have Daniel Matt. Here is Daniel. I brought him into the picture. And Daniel is a scholar, and he's really an authoritative figure in the Kabbalistic world. You know, there's so much that I can share with you about Daniel. He published over a dozen books, including The God and the Big Bang. That was, I think, in 95. 9 volumes of the Zohar, and we will talk about the Zohar. The Zohar, which is the masterpiece, really, of Kabbalah. And he recently finished the entire 12 volumes of the Zohar that was published by Stanford University Press. Yeah. And so for this work also, Daniel has been honored with the National Jewish Book Award and the Koret Jewish Book Award. The Koret Award called his translation a monumental contribution to the history of Jewish thought. Daniel, Hanan, Matt, welcome. Thank you very much for taking your time and for blessing our time here and the viewers with your presence and knowledge. Thank you.
Thank you. You know, when I was working on the Zohar, one of the commentators on the Zohar is an ancestor of yours, I believe, a man named Avraham Azulay. Mm-hmm. And his work on the Zohar was very helpful to me. So it's nice to meet his descendant and discuss Kabbalah.
Well, you know, it's a big weight on the shoulders, you know. So I'm grateful. You know, it's really interesting that how everything is bottlenecking up to here, is how everything comes in, you know, into being. You know, you talked in one of your lectures in 2012, God is not a static being, but a dynamic becoming. And it's really captivating, because this is really, I feel, you know, everything that is happening in our lives and how we choose, you know, the power of choice, how we choose where to be, is really a dynamic evolution. Is a dynamic, evolution by default is dynamic, but a dynamic really understanding and perception. How did you, tell us about you more. You'll do a much greater job than I can. it's just wonderful. I'm glad for you to be here.
Well, thank you. Well, I think, you know, when I was growing up, one of the formative influences in my life, of course, for everyone, it's your father and mother. My father was a rabbi, and I always looked up to him and learned from him. And really, I think I fell in love with Torah because I was in love with him, and he was teaching Torah. And I just wanted to imitate him, wanted to explore what he was doing, what he was about. And he always talked about God. I didn't know who God was, but I knew who my father was a little bit, and I knew that God was important to him. So he really taught me how to sing Jewish prayers and study the Bible in Hebrew. And I remember, you know, always wondering when I was growing up, you know, who is this? What is this? And then later in my late teenage years, I discovered Hasidism, Hasidic stories, Hasidic tales through the writings of Martin Buber.
Mm.
And that really captivated me because Hasidism really tries to, as you were saying, tries to find God within. So it's no longer imagining someone up there in heaven who's running the show, but an energy that's animating the universe and that we can feel inside of us. And that really felt so much more exciting and possible to experience. So I just followed that thread of Jewish mysticism. I started studying Hasidic texts in Hebrew, and I noticed that those Hasidic texts would often quote from a book called the Zohar.
Mm-hmm.
And the Zohar is, as you mentioned, the masterpiece of the Kabbalah, the major work of Jewish mysticism, but it's written in a very strange style. It's written in a foreign language, first of all, in Aramaic.
Yeah.
So even if you know Hebrew, you can't necessarily make sense of Aramaic. And it was a book that was not clear.
It was cryptic.
Intentionally cryptic.
Yeah.
But these Hasidic stories, Hasidic tales, Hasidic teachings would quote one line, one phrase that made sense from the Zohar. And every few pages, I would run across a phrase or a word or a line from the Zohar. And that intrigued me. And I wanted to study it. And finally, my junior year abroad, I was studying at Brandeis near Boston, but my junior year abroad, I went to Israel, to Jerusalem, and I studied for 1 year at the Hebrew University,
mm-hmm.
and I figured that was my chance to delve into Zohar. And I began, so I took beginning Zohar and advanced Zohar at the same time.
Wow.
But I figured I had 1 year, so I figured I'd do both of them, and I was totally lost in advanced Zohar. But that didn't matter because I was also lost in beginning Zohar, because that's the way the Zohar is.
So you were in concert. You were in concert.
I was encountered by it. I was immersed in it. I was fascinated by it, and I really fell in love with that mystical interpretation of the Bible.
Mm.
And then I just studied it and studied it and made my way through it. And then I had the opportunity of, I actually translated selections from the Zohar. I wrote a book called Zohar, the Book of Enlightenment, which is really 2% of the Zohar. You might say the greatest hits of the Zohar.
So it's like the best of, so to speak?
Yeah. The greatest hits. The greatest hits of the Zohar.
Yeah.
That I did many years ago. But then in the mid-90s, 1990s, a wealthy Jewish family in Chicago, a woman in that family wanted very much to study the Zohar, but she didn't know Hebrew or Aramaic. She began studying with an Orthodox rabbi in Chicago. And after studying for a while, they were using an older English translation that's not so good. After studying for a while, this woman, Margot Pritzker, said to the rabbi, or the rabbi said to her, let's do a new translation. So they came up with the idea of doing a new translation. Why? So that she would be able to understand the Zohar.
Oh.
So they knew that I had worked on Zohar, and they approached me. And then I began translating the entire book, really, for her.
Wow.
To make it available more widely. But the initial motivation was so that she could
study it. So this was like a 20-year project.
We didn't know how long it would take. Basically, she asked me how long it would take. I told her 12 to 15 years. And she said, you're not scaring me. and that's actually how I decided to do it. But then it turned into a little bit longer. But the whole thing took about 20 years. The entire thing in English is, as you mentioned, 12 volumes. I did 9 of those. 9 of the 12 volumes covering the Zohar's commentary on the Torah. And there are 3 additional volumes covering other sections of the Bible that the Zohar interprets.
But we are in a congested time where I feel all the worlds are coming together, all like the dimensions that are closing in. Everything is coming to a contraction, so to speak, and we see things that we haven't mm-hmm. seen before. We experiences we haven't experienced before. And I feel that that relating aspects from your studies about the Zohar and the Torah here to relate to what we are experiencing today will help others to connect, let's say, to the Zohar from a different angle, from the angle of what is happening today. You know, because studying with rabbis, Rabbi Reese, for example, tells me, no, it doesn't matter where you come in to study from. It doesn't matter what door you open, really. As long as you open a door, and it's as long as we open a door to what attracts us, just like what attracted you in diving into mysticism, into Jewish mysticism, what can we bring into what is happening today with Corona, dictatorship style, really oppression coming, everybody's rising up, or most of everybody is rising up. How is that related in the teachings?
Right. Yeah, I think what to me is fascinating about the Zohar, it's really two things. One is what the Zohar says, and the second is just the fact that it's so creative, that it takes such a new approach to the tradition. So in a way, it teaches us certain specific things, but more than that, it inspires us to develop our own relationship to Torah. As you were saying, it doesn't matter so much where you enter. The point is to enter, to open the window. Right? Krishnamurti once said that what matters is to leave the window open. You can't predict what's going to come in. You can't be sure that you have absolute truth, but just to allow an opening. And that's what the Zohar does to the Torah. What you find again and again, almost every page, Rabbi Yehuda opened, Rabbi Shimon opened, Elazar opened.
Yeah.
And that means so many different things. It means they opened their talk, their discourse. It means they opened up the verse that they're looking at. They opened up what you're reading in the Bible and they found something new. And then, of course, it means they opened themselves. They left themselves a little bit open so that something fresh could come in. And the Zohar does that, and it stimulates us to do it. So I think you're right. It's not that the approach really shouldn't be to memorize everything that a certain book tells you. The approach should be, you know, I want this to open my mind. I want this to create new possibilities. One of the most beautiful names the Zohar gives to God is in Hebrew, Sod HaEfshar, the secret of the possible.
Yeah.
It's actually a name for God in the Kabbalah, not in the Zohar, but in other books of Kabbalah, the secret of the possible. And that's what is so valuable.
So basically challenging our perception is a gym for our imagination.
Yes. Challenging us to, right, not to be satisfied with our current understanding of who God is or who we are. And as you said, there's really this dynamic interrelationship between the divine and the human. And in the Zohar, it's not always clear whether the text is talking about God or talking about your own inner being. And it wants you to keep wondering, is this God? Is this something inside of me? And finally, you discover there's a divine spark within each of us, and we're able to contact that and hopefully to fan that spark into a flame.
Well, isn't it says that each one of us should look at the world as if it was created just for us, you know? And yet I say that it's not only about us, because if we look at it this way, the ego come and plays along.
right. No, there's a great Hasidic rabbi who said you should actually have in your pocket one piece of paper. On one side it says, Bishvili nivra ha'olam, the world is created for me. On the other side of the paper, it says, Va'anochi afar va'efer. I am dust and ashes.
Wow.
So to move back and forth between realizing how little we are, how puny we are, and how vast we are, how we can tap into the oneness of it all.
Wow.
I think that, you know, being able to navigate between those two poles, and as you said, there's a danger of getting stuck if you just get stuck in I am beautiful, I am great, then it's egomania.
Yeah.
And if you just put yourself down, then you can't get much done. So to be able to move between those two and to ideally to find a balance, a harmony.
Yeah. This is interesting because, you know, these times that we are where we are, what we're experiencing now with the coronic times. By the way, how are you doing this now? Are you giving lectures and everything via Zoom, or do you go, or is it, how is it happening now?
I began actually about a year and a half ago to teach Zohar on Zoom. Actually, the course is called Zohar Zoom.
Oh, that's great.
And when I did it a year and a half ago, people were doing it, but it wasn't, you know, taking over the world. But now, since the virus, the course is growing, and I think people find, I'm sure you find this, that we need some kind of spiritual program, some spiritual devotion to help us through these challenging times. And it's wonderful to meet together with a group and study Torah or Midrash or Talmud or, you know, spirituality Eastern, Western, to find the spiritual core.
Well, you know, we are actually having a spiritual structure. We just need to pay attention. For example, the Quranic times, as I call it, is really the most wonderful to find meaningful connections, because it lacks the bribe.
The bribe.
You know, the sentence in Judaism which says Shmirat Negiya, keeping the touch away.
Yeah.
You know, the touch is a bribe, as much as it's wonderful and it is connecting. But when we meet like that, it is a wonderful opportunity to first really get to know that person in relationships. When people come, because I see people are telling me, how am I going to meet somebody now? I'm telling them, what are you talking about? This is the best time to meet. So, yes, you know, there is not the physical touch, but there is the opportunity. Everything is an opportunity. There is the opportunity to really meet somebody to their core.
Right.
And when you eventually get together, then it's really the cherry on top of the cake, you know?
Uh-huh.
So I think there is as you said, right? It is the creativity, the opportunity that is here.
Well, let me say something for a moment about Corona, because this came up in the Zohar course. It's interesting. You know, Corona is the name it's called. It goes by various names. And in Hebrew, the word for Corona is Keter, because Keter means crown and Corona means crown. And Virus HaKeter is one of the names for it in Israel. But it's amazing, I'm sure you know, that in Kabbalah, Keter is a name for the highest level of divinity. God is described as having 10 qualities or 10 sefirot.
Mm-hmm.
And the very first one is Keter, the crown on the head of this divine human body, various aspects, right and left, various limbs. But the first one of all the 10 is Keter, the crown. And it sounds strange that we have such a beautiful name for the highest level of Kabbalah and for this devastating plague. But another name for Keter is Ayin, spelled Aleph Yud Nun. And Ayin is nothingness.
Mm-hmm.
But in mysticism, as I'm sure many of you know, nothing is actually a very positive term, because it doesn't mean nothing as a blank. It means no thingness, pure potential, that which could become anything. So it's really a combination of destruction and the possibility of creativity. And that connects to what you're saying. This time, which is so devastating for much of the world, is also a great opportunity to see things in a brand new way, to leave our patterns, to undo the patterns we're so used to, our habitual patterns.
And
there's something they're very liberating about that Ayin, that no-thingness.
The no-thingness, the endless. It really becomes like the beginning of everything. It's like the end of something, and at the same time, it's the beginning of everything. Does that have to do anything with, is that correlating to the Tzimtzum Shvira, and at the same moment there is Tikkun, which is the three stages
That comes up a little bit later in Kabbalah, that the notion of God is nothing. You find in the Zohar and in the early Kabbalists, when you come to the next great creative period of Kabbalah in Sfat, in Safed, that beautiful Galilean town that
many of us have been to.
There you had a new development of Kabbalah, a new flowering of Kabbalah, and the central figure there was a man named Yitzchak Luria, the Ari, the lion. And he taught this paradoxical theory about really what he's saying is that at the beginning, all there was God. There was nothing but divinity, an infinite ocean of the divine. So how could the world exist at all? If God filled all space, how could there be room for anything that wasn't God? So Luria teaches that God actually first, before he could create, God had to withdraw in all directions and leave an empty space, leave a void, leave a vacuum. And into that vacuum, the divine light could then flow in a measured way to create the world. But the energy was so much, the divine light poured in so powerfully that there was a shattering of the vessels, shivirata kelim, a breaking of the vessels, and the light that was supposed to create the world, instead, the vessels that were conveying that light couldn't withstand the power of the light. They shattered, and from that moment on, there are sparks of divinity. The world did come into existence, but there are sparks of God hidden within everything, within all material objects, within every human being. And the spiritual task is what you mentioned, tikkun, the repair or mending, to bring back some harmony, to restore harmony. And that's what we are meant to do by acting virtuously, by learning how to care for one another, by healing the planet. In other words, we're actually partners with God. That's one of the radical teachings of the Kabbalah, that God needs us. God can't do it by himself or herself. So we bring about this reintegration or this tikkun.
You're talking about the creativity of the Zohar really thrives or encourages creativity, which means new interpretations all the time. Right. And I've studied that Judaism really is like a cumulative religion, a cumulative faith. So you cannot retract from what have been said up until, but you can always add, right? Now, in when we're talking about the Maaseh Merkabah that was talked in Yeheskel before, way before, to get to a certain level, you have to have the knowledge of the Torah, the observance of the mitzvot of the Torah, and live ethically. Now, in a faith or religion that is a cumulative faith, where in every generation you have rabbis that are adding to, and which mitzvot of the Torah are you going to keep? Those who were initially prescribed, so to speak, or those who are accumulated to it? And maybe the accumulations of these mitzvot are hindering from seeing and getting certain things done.
No, I think here it's where that creativity is so important. The Zohar is emphasizing creativity, but really what it comes down to is, you know, interpreting the Torah. Because right from the start, the Torah really was too hard to follow. Right? People, the rabbis changed the Torah by interpreting it. And then the Kabbalah changed Rabbinic Judaism by interpreting it. And Hasidism changed Kabbalah by interpreting it. And we have to change whatever we've inherited through that creative interpretation. I'll give you an example. The very first verse of the Bible, right? In the beginning, God created. Bereshit bara Elohim. It's very clear what that means. It's pretty clear what that means. In the beginning, God created. But it's interesting. The Hebrew actually says, Bereshit, in the beginning, bara, created, Elohim, God. So it's in the beginning, created God. Now, it doesn't matter that you have a subject coming after the verb, created God. We do that sometimes in English too, like thus spoke the king.
Exactly.
It means the king spoke. So in the beginning, created God. It means in the beginning, God created. But the Zohar says, no, let's read it exactly in the order it comes. In the beginning, it created, because the word created can also mean it created. In the beginning, it created God. That's how the Zohar interprets the beginning of the Torah. Not that God created, that God was created.
In the Hebrew version or in the Aramaic?
I mean, the Aramaic of the Zohar is saying that the Hebrew of the Torah means in the beginning, it created God. So God is actually the object of creation, not the subject.
Oh, wow.
That sounds very bizarre, But then you wonder, okay, if God's the object, then who created God?
Wow.
So the Zohar really says the ultimate reality of God, that's what we call Ein Sof, infinity. What we call God is already a secondary thing.
And that's why they say that, that's why it says that Bereshit, the letter Bet, comes second. It's the second letter of the alphabet, which means there was an Aleph, an A, a Hebrew, before that.
Right.
But that's interesting, you know. As I kind of mentioned, all these 2 weeks have been a chain of events that have been manifested, at least in my life, in my experience, and with the people that I know and people that I work with, but in my experience, where all this information and people that have been appearing in my life and as a shluchim come, give information, go.
Mm-hmm.
Come
mm-hmm.
And really the information that is related to either spiritual beings or outside beings, outside different species that are coming into this place, and the information that is being received through them about them and about creation mm-hmm. that is challenging, really, is challenging this old perception, this old stories, and it's like telling me, Ilan, challenge that. Don't be afraid to challenge us, because many times it's the fear about challenging that draws me back, not the challenge itself. It's just the thought about the challenge. And it's so interesting that you're saying that now, because I always had the problem with the English language. For example, when it says Bereshit bara Elohim tarararam aya veaya yom echad. Yom Echad. Mm-hmm. Echad means a day. Doesn't hint on a sequential day. But in many English versions, it says day one or the first day.
The first day.
Which is hinting to a sequential day. But there was no, I didn't get from the Hebrew Torah that there is a sequence.
Yeah.
Well, this is fascinating.
Yes, this really that applies, you know, to God too, to say that God is one. It's not one as in one, two, three. It's really God is oneness.
Oneness.
That's how the mystics reinterpret. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. It doesn't mean that there's one God. That, of course, that's basic.
There's oneness from the place
now of one. It means God is the oneness of it all.
Wow.
So to say every day, in other words, now that declaration of the Shema, if you actually meditate every day on God being oneness, then that becomes the basis of your religion. I think, you know, what's something you said before, which mitzvot do you keep? Which commandments should you keep and which should you question? It's an interesting idea in Judaism. How many commandments are there?
16,
you know, how many, if you look at the Bible and you look at them traditionally, the rabbis say there's 613 commandments. Now, that sounds like quite a lot. And actually, if you count up the number of them that apply today, it's probably something like 100. But there's a Hasidic teaching that says, you know how many commandments there are? Look at the verse in Proverbs, "Bechol derachecha da'ehu." In all your ways, know God. So there's a Hasidic teaching that says, if you actually take that verse seriously, then there's an infinite number of mitzvot. Because anything you do can become an opportunity to experience
God.
That divine energy can experience God.
Wow.
So everything becomes a mitzvah. You don't have to follow a set list of commandments. You can moment by moment discover ways to cultivate your awareness.
But wow, this is in some way there is a knowledge of that. In some way, it's kind of something that was known, like in a Vedic sense. But it is like almost a fear of approaching that kind of an understanding.
Right. There's a fear that if you just tell people do it on your own, people will fool themselves, people will stumble, people will convince themselves that they found the truth. Right. We always want to find the truth, but there's really no final absolute truth that's gonna work for you every day and that's gonna work for every person. So the tradition, as you said, is cumulative. The tradition keeps adding. And we're at a point now where we have to look very critically and very skeptically at everything that's piled up over the millennia, but we need certain guidelines. And I think one guideline is the line that you began with tonight, the line from the Torah, perhaps the most beautiful line in the Torah, love your neighbor as yourself. So if you say, I'm going to take that seriously, I'm going to take seriously loving God and loving your neighbor. Rabbi Akiva said, those are the two most important mitzvot. And Jesus said, those are the two most important mitzvot. So you have a great Christian teacher and a great Jewish teacher agreeing you should love God and love your neighbor. And then you look at all the tradition. You say, what elements within the tradition are going to help me love God? What elements within the tradition are going to help me love my neighbor? Those are going to become my toolkit. Those are going to become my mitzvot. And that may change. It'll change from now till next year. But I think you're right. We have to be flexible. We have to be open. We have to be eager. We have to be passionate about learning. We should delve into all of the wisdom we can. And then we should fashion for ourselves a path that will lead us to something fulfilling.
Well, you know, first of all, Jesus wasn't Christian. So it's later, way, way later, they made him one.
to appreciate Jesus as a Jewish teacher, it's a very difficult thing for Jews to do because of the millennia of anti-Semitism, because of the persecution, the suffering. Well, so it's natural to have an animosity toward that, but the animosity
is taught, it's example of challenging a perception, challenging something that.
Right.
We were taught and we were fed with several spoons, not one spoon. It is really hard in today's world, also between a couple, to love somebody in the same way that I love myself. I mean, most of the times, many people don't really know if they love themselves. You know, so it's kind of hard even to love somebody else. However, if we bring it down to a practical level, I can express love to somebody else by wishing for them all the best and the wonderful things that I would wish for myself. So it's kind of a down to here practical day to day to say, okay,
yes,
you know,
that's exactly what Moshe Cordovero says in Tomer Devorah.
That's right,
beautiful book of Kabbalistic Musar, ethical mystical literature, and he says exactly that. Loving your neighbor means wanting the best for him and feeling his pain. So that having empathy. And you're right, you know, the verse itself says, it doesn't say love your neighbor, it says love your neighbor as yourself. You only know how to love your neighbor if you can love yourself.
That's right.
If you don't love yourself, it's very hard to love someone else, but you don't want to get carried away just with self-love, of course.
That's right, because then we're going to the same point of the ego. You know, in the book, Daniel wrote a book, The God and the Big Band, God and the Big Band. And the first line that you start that book with, you bring the understanding of the world that was created some 15 billion years ago. Okay, now, rabbis won't agree with you there, right? So are you saying that encompassing all the worlds, all the kelim that were broken, all the worlds that were created and broken from the inception of let's create something?
I mean, look, if you look at biblical chronology, right, and you add up all of the decades and the centuries and the people who lived, right, you end up with, you know, something close to 6,000 years.
Yeah.
Right, according to the traditional Jewish calendar, we have about 220 years to go. Right now, we're at 5780.
Yes,
and you know, by another 220 years, we'll get to 6,000. According to the Talmud, the world exists for 6,000 years, and then it will lie destroyed for Shabbat for 1,000 years. Then maybe we'll have another cycle. So I'm not trying to match up the exact chronology of the Bible with you know, what modern cosmology teaches, which is about 13.7 billion years. The Bible has its way of describing how things began, and science has its way of describing how things began. You can find some parallels, you can find a lot of differences, but even a cosmologist would not claim to know how the ultimate beginning happened. it's still something of a mystery to a cosmologist. A cosmologist can go back to a fraction of a second, right? A tiny fraction of a second before, after the beginning, not to the absolute beginning. So how the universe actually began ultimately is still a mystery, even to cosmology. But I see beautiful, profound teachings. I've really, when I was growing up, I said I was a rabbi's son. When I was growing up, I was always wondering, who has it right? Is it the Torah or the scientists?
Yeah.
Because I was growing up in a modern, liberal, sophisticated home, and my parents were educated, and I was meant to appreciate science, not to challenge evolution. I understood in high school a little bit about that. But I always wondered, wait a minute, the Torah seems to be describing this, and the scientists said this. So that book, God and the Big Bang, it really came out of years and years of wondering who has it right. And I finally, by searching and exploring, I came to the conclusion that each of them has one piece of the puzzle. Mm. Science and religion really, really have something to teach each other. Nobody has the full story. But when we find where there is harmony, we should celebrate that. And where they disagree, it's okay to criticize, right? It's interesting. How does science progress? Science progresses by proving itself wrong.
That's true.
Right? That's really how science makes progress. Now, how does religion progress? Religion doesn't, as you said, it's more cumulative. Religious thinkers are very hesitant to criticize
themselves.
What came earlier.
Yeah, it's like, let's not criticize ourselves. Let's just add, in case we were wrong and we were right, let's just add everything.
Right. But that's why the Kabbalah, through its radical creative interpretation, it really does turn things upside down, right? So a moment ago, we were looking at, in the beginning, the infinite created what we think of as God. What we think of as God is not the ultimate God. There's something beyond it which brought us into being and even what we call God into being. But the Zohar loves to do that to the Torah. I'll give you another example. One of the first stories in the Bible, of course, is Adam and Eve in the garden. And then Adam and Eve eat from the fruit of knowledge. And they find themselves, God expels them from the garden, right? So the Hebrew says in chapter 3 of Genesis, Vayigaresh et ha'adam. He expelled Adam. But the Zohar says something interesting. The Zohar says, who threw whom out of the garden? And the Zohar actually suggests that we threw God out of the garden. Now you might say, we're really still in the garden. But we don't realize it because we've lost touch with the spiritual dimension.
We're just talking about this week. I mean, I have the chills go over. I was talking about heaven on earth, It's so, right. So, wow. So I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go continue.
No. That's such a radical idea. Now, really, something we haven't spoken about yet and that the Zohar has in mind there is the Shekhinah. Shekhinah is the name for the feminine dimension of God. Mm-hmm. That word appears earlier, not in the Bible, but in the Talmud and the Midrash. In rabbinic writings, Shekhinah means God's presence in the world. But in Kabbalah, Shekhinah is the feminine half of God. And there's actually a romance within God. There's a male and female energy within the divine, and they are in love with each other, but they can't unite unless we stimulate their romance. Anytime that we act lovingly, anytime that we act virtuously, you might say that's an aphrodisiac for the divine romance. Mm. So we stimulate the Shekhinah and her divine male partner to unite if we lead ethical lives, if we lead spiritual lives. And there too, we have an example of God needing us.
Yeah. So,
but I was going to say Shekhinah is so important because so much of religion, right? All of Western religion, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, they're all so dominated by the male perspective.
That's right.
Right, the patriarchal society, right. And our own challenges now with gender and sexism. So much of that is due to the religious teaching, and all of Western religious teaching paints God as primarily masculine. The most radical thing that the Kabbalah does is to criticize that. Here, the Kabbalah is really offering a critique of traditional theology and saying, you've missed half of the picture. God isn't male. God is male and female. Ultimately, God is beyond all gender. But if we're going to call God male, we have to balance that with Shekhinah, the feminine. That's one of the great contributions of the Kabbalah.
That is amazing. Doesn't feminine right. needs to exist first in order to have the breeding ground to create masculine?
I mean, you might say it makes much more sense to say that God is a woman than to say that God is a man. If the world came into being, if we came into being, then God gave birth to us. So there's something more accurate yeah. about calling God feminine or female than masculine or male.
How does the Zohar deals, because even the Torah is written, the Hebrew language itself is a masculine language. You know, you can have 1,000 women in a room and one male in the room, and you still refer to everybody as their male.
Hashem.
Right?
Yeah.
So how does the Zohar deals with that? With that in a language. Now in English you can say you and you can mean to a female and male. So maybe that's kind of a shortcut and it's an easy way to pass that. But how does the language?
Yeah, what the Zohar does is to play with the Hebrew language. For example, you have a beautiful word in Hebrew, et, yeah. Aleph Taf. Now that's a word in Hebrew that means nothing. In other words, you really can't translate it. In Hebrew, as you know, you can't say, I drink the water. You have to say, I drink et the water. You can't say, I see the sky. You have to say, I see et the sky. In other words, et introduces a direct object. That's its main function in Hebrew. But the Zohar says, no, look at that word et. How is it spelled? It has the first letter of the alphabet, Aleph,
yeah.
and the last letter of the alphabet, Taf.
This
is like we say from Alpha to Omega. The first to the last. So Aleph to Tav, that becomes a name for Shekhinah.
Wow.
That's one of her names. Why is she Aleph to Tav? Because she includes all of the divine qualities. She's the feminine. She includes the male and the female. She is A to Z. She is Aleph to Tav.
Wow.
The Zohar loves to interpret that word, that little word, that little magical word as the divine feminine.
This is amazing. This is fascinating. I mean, I want to ask you to. We're almost done, but I want to ask you one more subject. But before that, the Torah, for the most part, is really teaching us about us, like you said. It's really for us. It's the pardes. It's the simplest. It's the story level, the hinted level, the deep level, and the mystery. These mm-hmm. four levels of right. the four quality levels. But on the story levels, in the Torah, we have so many stories that for me, since I was a child, were contradicting in the concept. For example, there is the story of the guy that cut wood on Shabbat,
mm.
right? And the mob, the people, brought this guy to Moses and says, he cut trees on Shabbat. What should we do with him? It's like a 20,000 people mob bringing him. Now he says, okay, let me go into the tent and let me talk to God. And I come. 3 days later, he comes out and says, God said, kill him. Now, you know, it contradicts to everything that is ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. You know? The question is, mm-hmm. How do we challenge that as we are encouraged to challenge? How do we challenge a story that on the surface appears to please the mob or to please the political state of, for example, Moses?
Yeah.
Now, I'm not, God forbid, I'm not demeaning anybody and I don't want to offend anybody here that is listening.
Right.
It is really for the pure, it's with the disconnect of the emotional connection to anything. It's just looking at something as is. And asking a question to trigger something. So this is, how yeah. do you look at that?
Yeah, I think, you know, there are troubling stories in the Bible, certainly that, or, you know, killing off nations. I'm working now, for example, on Elijah the prophet. It's an amazing figure, but he has a very harsh, violent side too, slaughtering the prophets of Baal.
Mm.
I think there are a number of things. First, yeah, Asherah.
We just talked about Shirana. This week. I'm sorry. I just talked about this week. Baal and Ashtoret, and that's the next question. But sorry, go ahead.
that's very important. Baal and Ashtoret, she goes by various names. Ashtoret, Asherah. But Shekhinah, I mean, we're talking about Shekhinah as the feminine. You do have a feminine in ancient Israel, right? It is that Canaanite goddess.
That's right.
And we know that there were Israelites who were attracted to worshiping the goddess. Some of them, in fact, wanted to combine the goddess with Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, with the God of Israel. They wanted to accept the God of Israel, but they wanted him to have a wife, a spouse. So the prophets, of course, are criticizing the people, right? Castigating the people for going after the false gods and goddesses. So the goddess is eliminated from the Bible. The goddess is eliminated from Judaism. But eventually she comes back as Shekhinah.
Hmm.
Shekhinah is really the return of the goddess.
So is it the return of Ashtoret?
Ashtoret and Asherah are the same.
So it's the return of the Shekhinah as the Shekhinah, comes back as the Shekhinah.
The ancient goddess now comes back as Shekhinah.
Oh, wow.
And in fact, the Zohar says something amazing. This is, I think, the most radical thing in the whole Zohar. The Zohar says that Shekhinah's original name was Asherah.
Oh, man.
That's actually shocking. That's really shocking.
You know, there was in 1977 an interruption in the British broadcast as they say, was an interruption from the Ashtora Galactic Command, right? I will send you that clip. And inside, and they're talking about really how how they're moving through, and how we are really damaging and going into the negative. And every so few seconds, back in 77, there wasn't really a digital way of stopping frames. But they put every so many frames, they put a slide, like a subliminal message slide. And one of the slides is taken from Shoftim Bet, Judges 2, verse 13, where it's talking about, and they left God and they worked Baal and Ashtoret. I just talked about it this week with another wonderful person, and it is fascinating. That's why I talked to you in the beginning, how everything is channeling, how everything is coming together, all the information, everything. Now we talk about this. So
it's to then see that forbidden goddess can somehow be reclaimed.
Wow.
So there's a way to go back to the earlier layers of tradition and to penetrate them and to see, you know, a new way to appreciate what in the past was rejected.
Wow. And
Sholem.
Sorry?
Gershom Sholem calls this the revenge of myth.
I met him many years ago.
He was a wonderful teacher.
I met him many years ago. I'll tell you later, but
I was his teaching assistant one year.
Oh, wow.
He was brought to Boston University one semester to teach, and my professor was a colleague of his, and Sholem asked him to find a few TAs, and he asked me to, that was a real thrill.
Wow, that was in Israel when I met him many, many years ago.
Yes, at his home?
No, actually he came to my family's house. There was kind of a debate between him and another anti-missionary. An anti-missionary, a person that was, it was a really interesting encounter. But I want to ask you a last question about the external books, what Judaism are calling the external books of Enoch, of Enoch, and really talking about the Nephilim and about the extraterrestrials. And why is Judaism Judaism of today so against it, against talking about that? And yet it's still considered Judaism, but it's an external book. It's like saying, we're not teaching these books, but it's in our basement. But we're not teaching these books.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, it's like kind of like...
Yeah. Well, you know, many religious traditions have a canon, right? All religious traditions have a canon, which really means we're going to decide which books are kosher. right? What are the holy books? And in order to create that canon, you always exclude certain other literatures.
Yeah.
And the Christian church does that, and the rabbis did that when they were canonizing the Torah. In fact, you know, there was an argument about some of the books that are in the Bible, whether they should be in the Bible or not. The Kohelet, the book of Ecclesiastes, almost didn't make it into the Bible. The Song of Songs, because it's such erotic love poetry, there was a real argument, should that be in? So those made it in, and other books did not make it in. Basically, the books that did not make it in were books that were more mythological, telling mythical stories about Enoch, for example, who went up to heaven and became an angel, or other mythological beings, like you mentioned, the Nephilim, the fallen angels. So those books are there in the background, and because they're forbidden, they're also attractive to people. So through the ages, there were rabbis who wanted to study them. In the Talmud, you have stories about, you know, rabbis who were studying things that seemed to be not fully accepted. In a way, the Zohar is flirting with that material and trying to present it in a more traditional kosher form. So the Zohar does draw on the Enoch literature. And the Zohar talks about some of the things that are in that those outside books. But now, as you were saying, you know, at the beginning of our discussion, now everything is available, right? You don't even have to leave your house. You can find anything online. You can find any text, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, Sufi, whatever you want and more is going to be there, whether your tradition recognizes it, approves of it or not. So there's almost, there's too much, right? The problem isn't that we can't find things. The fact that there's too much, How do we decide what to study next?
That's right. How? That will be in the class, in the lesson.
But let me say just a word or two about my course,
please.
And you can you know include links.
I will include links and everything.
Great. I'll send you one link, and people can really basically. I'm teaching a course on Zohar called Zohar Zoom.
Yeah,
and Ilan will provide you with a link, but if you just Google my name, Daniel Matt, and Zohar course or Zohar class, you'll find it. It's a once a week course I do on Zoom, and people can watch it live or watch videos afterward. People usually sign up for one series, which consists of 6 weekly Zoom meetings. We meet for 6 weeks, and then we take a break for a week or two or more, and then begin another series. Now we're actually beginning series 10. I've been teaching it for about a year and a half. But with Zohar, it doesn't matter where you begin. It doesn't really matter if you begin at the beginning or in the middle. Wherever you begin, you're going to be lost. And it's something of a challenge and an adventure. Some people have done it from the beginning, series 1 through 10. Some people joined this week or last week. You can take a look at the description through the link that Ilan will provide, or if you Google Daniel Matt Zohar course or Zohar class. Basically, we're moving through the Zohar series by series using my translation, the Zohar Pritzker edition. That's the name for this 12-volume series, of which I wrote the first 9 volumes, translation and commentary. And we do a few pages a week. We do about 5 or 6 pages a week in the English. I also make the Aramaic available, and some people follow in the original Aramaic, but I'm teaching the course for people who have never studied Zohar before, even who haven't studied Jewish texts extensively before.
Amazing.
If you have a little bit of knowledge of the Torah, that certainly helps, but we move very slowly, and we just read and discuss and explore this masterpiece of Jewish mysticism.
This is amazing. Everyone, I really recommend even just to give it a taste. If you've been in this, if you've been in this broadcast, you can just imagine this is a tip of a tip of a tip of a tip of an iceberg that is a huge thing, and it is fascinating.
Let me say, please, too, that the description, the course description, which you can find through Ilan or through Googling, there I give some links to free sample sessions, the free meetings. You'll see an example of what the course is like, where we're studying and exploring. I'll tell you, right now there are about 150 people in the course. There are about 40 rabbis, And then I would say there may be another 40 people who know hardly anything about Torah or Judaism or Hebrew. And the middle is people who have studied something, who know a little Hebrew, but there's a beautiful range. About half the people participate live each week and about half watch the videos afterward.
Amazing, amazing.
Great.
Professor Dr. Daniel Matt, thank you so much for taking your time. I want this to be an encouragement for everyone to challenge the perception, to understand that everything is a possibility. Everything is like standing in the middle of a football field. Everything is possible. Thank you so much for being here, for embracing us with your presence, and for the knowledge, the vast knowledge, and the inspiration. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ilan. It's beautiful to talk with someone whose name means tree and the tree of the Sfirot and the fertility. So good to be with you.
Thank God. Thank you.
כשהקרקע פוריה, כשהאוויר נקי ומבוסם. ניסים לא קורים כך סתם. הם מטפסים בעלייה בזיכרון שלא היה. מכווצים, מכונסים בתוך עצמם. מחכים לאות, ממתינים לסימן. יש אסונות שעשויים מחלומות מרוסקים. יש אנשים שמאבדים ולא מוצאים. והשמיים הם פתוחים, העננים קלים קלים. אבל אני חלמתי על השלמת הניצחון שלא היה. מכווצים, מכונסים בתוך עצמם. מחכים לאות, ממתינים לסימן. יש אסונות שעשויים מחלומות מרוסקים. יש אנשים שמאבדים ולא מוצאים. השמיים הם פתוחים, העננים קלים קלים. אבל אני חלמתי על ניסים. ובאוויר עכשיו יש ריח של דם ויזע ואבק של כוכבים. כשאת עורר אמשיך לחלום, כי התרגלתי לכבוד, כי התרגלתי לכבוד.
You're listening to Abracadabra, Create What You Speak, with Ilan Azulay, only on LA Talk Radio.